Our next speaker is Christos Tavatsikos. Hope I got that right, Christos. Computational imaging pattern analysis methods for imaging-based biomarkers of autism. Christos.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Nick, for organizing this nice session. I'm with the Department of Radiology, a section of biomedical image analysis at the University of Pennsylvania. I would like to discuss some of the techniques that have been developed over the past decade or so, and they have been used in a number of imaging fields, a little less in autism than they have been used perhaps in other areas such as Alzheimer's disease and so forth, but they're very promising in terms of integrating different information from imaging and non-imaging measurements and coming up with patterns that are perhaps subtle to discern, but possibly very predictive and diagnostic. So there's a number of studies that have looked at AST in terms of brain structure, function, and connectivity. But the question still is there, is there an imaging phenotype of AST? And the answer is not clear for many reasons. Number one, largely many of these studies have been based on group analysis. So you have a number of AST participants, a number of controls, and you find some group differences that if you have a sufficiently large sample size, then you will find some significant differences. That doesn't mean that these are of diagnostic or predictive value. That doesn't mean that we can use this for diagnosis. And I just picked a simple example here from a study we have with Bob Schultz, who is right there at CHOP. And basically, this is children that have AST children and typical development controls. And these are, we picked a number of regions of interest in the brain where we measured the volumes to see if there is structural differences between groups, and there have been reported differences in the literature, which we also found and replicated. And you see here the histogram in red of controls and in blue of ASD subjects, and they are different. And if you have, based on our sample size, this is the lateral orbitofrontal gyrus, this is the inferior frontal gyrus, a speech-related area, and they are significantly different. However, it doesn't mean that if you measure any of these, you'll be able to tell with any specificity if someone has the imaging phenotype of autism. So the question is, can we do better than this, and how can we do that? Now, the problem is not that there is not an imaging phenotype of autism. The problem is that we're not lucky enough to have a situation like the one I show here schematically on the right. This is schematics of, say, group one, group two, say, ASD and controls. And if we're lucky to measure, for example, the volume or the functional activity in a specific region of the brain that precisely separates the two groups, we have a biomarker, and it's very easy. If you take this situation and you just rotate it a little bit, it's exactly the same situation where the two groups are distinct. But if you do that, then none of these regions, or any other region as a matter of fact, is sufficient by itself to provide an imaging phenotype that is specific enough. Again, the situation is exactly the same between left and right, but what happened is simply that there is a combination of different regions that you need to put together in order to classify or predict or whatever you want to do. So the question is, how do we find out which brain regions, which imaging modalities, which clinical variables, or ultimately genetic variables, do we need to put together in a model that is diagnostic or predictive? And what would that model be? And this is some of my work and others. Fortunately, in imaging, we have to our avail some techniques that have prevailed in the past decade or so. They moved us from the a priori hypothesis of regions of interest to a more exploratory analysis where you can interrogate every part of the brain without making any a priori hypothesis and essentially asking the question, is this voxel or that brain region different in autism compared to controls? So this, again, from Bob Schultz's studies at CHOP, where we are analyzing some of the structural data, and we find regions that are significantly different between controls and AST subjects. And some of them have larger gray matter volumes, some of them have smaller gray matter volumes, and so forth for white matter. It's a complex picture, as you see here. It's not just a single brain region that is involved. And if you add more modalities, if you add structural connectivity with diffusion imaging, if you add functional connectivity, you will see different things. So it's not an easy picture. Let me skip this for now. But the question is, can we put it all together? using pattern classification methods, which for some people is a black box, for some other people like me who are interested in what is in this, it's not. But basically, let's treat it as a black box right now, which is trained by a number of, by databases of images or non-imaging data that has identified some pattern. And we learn to find which variables we need to actually measure in order to diagnose, to find this pattern in a new image or set of images. So the goal is to find if this region and that region, if for example, in structural images and that region in functional images and so forth, need to be put together in order to come up with a score that in our work we call the SPARE ASD score. We largely borrow this from our work in Alzheimer's disease, but basically this stands for spatial patterns for the imaging patterns for the recognition of ASD. What this system's output is a positive score if you have the imaging phenotype of ASD and a negative score if you don't. And a number of groups, so I tried to collate a few slides here from a number of groups that have taken similar approaches. And this is by no means a comprehensive review of the literature. It's just a few examples to highlight the promises, but also to highlight the pitfalls of these methods, which were very well actually elaborated in the previous talk. This is from a UCSD study where they used some linear discriminants in a number of brain regions that you see down here to the right that were put together, that were found to form a pattern that is reasonably distinctive. And their classification accuracy was very high, 94%. Classification accuracy between high function and low functioning individuals were less promising, but still pretty good given the difficulty of the problem. So there's promise here. However, there's also issues to be followed up in the future because this study was not cross-validated. So in other words, what happens to be a good separating model in the training set is not necessarily going to work well on new data sets. That doesn't mean that these results are not promising or they're not true, but it just means that we have to be careful and replicate this on new samples or use some jackknifing statistical cross-validation method where you leave some of the data out and you recycle the data so that you actually get a better estimate of how well these predictive tools would do in a new sample. But the underlying problem is the curse of dimensionality. If you measure too many things, and we do measure too many things here, there are too many brain regions and too many modalities and too many variables that we measure. There's what is called in computer science the curse of dimensionality, or in statistics, you can show even mathematically that if you measure a lot of things, you can separate any data. Just randomly label any data, you'll be able to make a very nice predictive model or diagnostic model. It's guaranteed, in fact. So the issue is that we have to very carefully cross-validate these and apply pretty well-known techniques. So this is another study, Eckhart et al. From London. So this was another promising study which found a very complex pattern of volumetric differences in a number of brain regions which have been named, have been colored in blue or red depending on ASD had larger volumes than controls or vice versa. So as you see, the picture is not simple. It's not a simple brain region that is involved here. But together, if they had a very good accuracy. I haven't noted the accuracy here, but it was in the upper 80s or close to 90%, if I recall properly. Very promising results. Again, I carefully looked at this at some point. I said, oops, we have to be a little careful here because the initial explanation perhaps is that there are some brain regions are larger in autism and some brain regions are smaller. But if you look carefully here, what you see in the circles is that essentially what is larger in gray matter is smaller in white matter or vice versa, and it's across the board. So it's not to say that this classification is not right. It is, and it was properly cross-validated, but maybe the interpretation is different from what one would immediately think at first. Maybe this shows that there are myelination differences between the two groups, and in conjunction with some of the limitations of automated computer analysis algorithms, particularly image segmentation into gray matter and white matter, they might appear to give volumetric differences, but actually the underlying problem, the underlying difference might be actually a difference in myelination, which will slightly change the MRI signal, and an area that would otherwise be called white matter is called gray matter, and so forth. So when you see these kinds of things where gray and white matter have the opposite effects, you have to start thinking about, number one, technical issues, and number two, the interpretation. One of Nick's studies that was mentioned before, very promising results, I think is the highest. I didn't record an AUC, maybe Nick will remember that, but essentially it's in the low 90s. And a number of brain regions seem to have different fractional isotropy and be predictive. Again, it's a small test set. It was 19 people totally, and these things need to be replicated in a larger. This was the training set was 16, the test set was 19. Yeah. So very promising. Again, we need larger sample sizes. This from some of our work with Bob Schultz and others, where we use similar methods. It's slightly larger. This was a 48 participants. We use cross-validation, so every time you leave one subject out, you train your model on the rest, and you apply it, and you reshuffle the data. A very promising area under the curve of 0.9. The accuracy is in the 80s. Again, some of the pitfalls here is if you look more carefully, this is the classification accuracy. This is even the training accuracy, actually, as a function of the number of brain regions that you sample. And it reaches high levels if you sample a few regions that are the most distinctive. But then if you start adding information, it goes down. Now, this is a well-known effect in people working in this field, in computer science and machine learning, that you have essentially, as you add information, you do better. And as you keep adding irrelevant information that doesn't help, you start doing worse. So you have to find that optimal point. But what you hope for is to have a better plateau. So otherwise, your algorithms and your predictive models can be very sensitive, and this might contribute to the lack of generalization. So, again, one of the keys here is larger sample sizes. In imaging, we are very limited most of the time with very small sample sizes. When you go to the genetic studies, you see huge sample sizes. And I think we need to work on at least pulling data together from different centers or increasing the ends, because these pattern recognition methods are very powerful, but also they do need a lot of data to be able to decipher these multivariate relationships in the data that build these patterns. A number of regions in our classification schemes were found to be important for classification. Some temporal lobe regions, some anterior corpus callosum, which might reflect reduced connectivity, interhemispheric connectivity in autism, and a very strong area around the fusiform gyrus, which also agrees with some of Bob's functional imaging findings. So one of the issues is to put together all this data in the future, different imaging modalities, clinical data, and ultimately genetic data to do even better. Raghadi Verma in our group, who has a lab mainly focused on diffusion imaging and structural connectivity, has started to do some of this by integrating MEG and DTI. And what you see is what you expect, basically, that individually, MEG or DTI features were not very good in this particular study, but jointly they gave a better classification. This is a three-way classification, so it's a tough problem. The two-way classification gave 87%. Again, we see that some promise in functional imaging, some in structural imaging, some in MEG, some in perhaps in clinical measures, and at some point we need to put it all together. And this is Bob Schultz's work on using ICA on resting state fMRI, where they found a very significant pattern of connectivity that is different between ASD and controls. This is John Harrington's work working with Bob Schultz. So, how am I doing with time? How much time? Ah, okay. So I'm just actually close to wrapping up. I think I went too fast through this. But basically, another dimension that I'm particularly interested in is moving away from classification and into more continuous models. This is particularly important for two reasons. Number one, autism is a highly heterogeneous condition, and there are obviously different levels of functioning. Some of the autistic children are extremely high functioning, some are less functioning, and some of the controls actually have very big differences. So the question is, should we be looking at it in a dichotomous way, or should we try to find more continuous models? In other words, should we involve more pattern regression models? This was from the Ecker study that I showed earlier that showed that their classification scores actually correlated with AQ and ADOS. So this classification score scores also correlate with these clinical measures. But the question is, can we actually go back to the data instead of trying to build classifiers that categorize things into one or another bin? Can we actually see if we can find imaging patterns that predict cognitive performance or clinical measures? And we did that in Bob's data, where we took a number of measures. Here I'm showing the ADOS and the bend on facial recognition as two representative of clinical or cognitive measurements. And we found out that there are, even just using brain structure, you can predict to a reasonable extent the clinical or cognitive phenotype. This is correlation between the predicted, for example, Benton scores and the actual Benton scores. Given that these, the scores by themselves have quite a bit of noise in them, I was kind of positively surprised, I would say, by the accuracy in which, or at least by the degree of correlation between these two. This is all cross-validated. So always, all the data I'm showing from our studies are cross-validated. So perhaps we can start thinking about more continuous approaches rather than these dichotomic approaches. So in conclusion, pattern classification methods can identify imaging phenotypes that are quite distinctive in ASD individuals rather than compared to controls. And they can potentially become objective and quantitative biomarkers. The issue there, and the main value of these pattern classification methods, is that the phenotype is not necessarily present in one brain region or another specifically, or one imaging measurement, or one clinical measurement, or one genetic measurement, because the same measures can be, the same methods can be used to combine genetic data. But it's in the combination it's the combination that makes this pattern very distinctive. And sometimes, in a very layman's terms, I tend to use an example of looking at someone's face, someone's eye color. If you block one eye and you look at the right eye, you see a brown colored eye. You say, that's pretty normal. That's, you know, pretty standard. If you block the other eye, you see a blue eye. You say, that's pretty standard too. I know many people with blue eyes. But if you see both of them simultaneously, that's an unusual pattern to have a blue and a brown eye. So basically, that's the idea, that there's something in the combination that forms a pattern that is distinctive. Pattern regression methods, I think, have a lot of promise and in terms of taking a continuous approach rather than a dichotomous approach, and also in terms of better dealing with spectrum disorders that might have more than one phenotypes, if you want. And ultimately, I think we need to integrate structural, diffusion, fMRI, MEG, clinical, cognitive, and genetic data to come up with more distinctive phenotypes. And I think that's what was that relates to the comment that was made before. There are plenty of pitfalls, and we have to be very watchful. The curse of dimensionality and the risk of overfitting is the number one, and we see it all the time. These methods have to be properly cross-validated. We should never be looking at how well a model fits the data, but how well this model generalizes to new data. We need larger sample sizes because finding these complex relationships needs a lot of data. We need to be concerned, or we need to be watchful about how we interpret the findings, because the same finding might be interpreted in different ways, and I showed one example before. And one thing that is striking, both in the imaging literature and in the genetic literature, is that the findings are quite diverse. I mean, it is a little concerning that there's really not two studies that have found exactly the same imaging phenotype. And that might be due to the heterogeneity of disease, pathological instabilities, and a number of other a number of technical reasons that could potentially be overcome. But it's something that we need to watch for, because eventually we want to find stable and reproducible imaging phenotypes. And of course, above all, most of these studies look at children with autism at later ages. The question is, can we predict early? Can these tools be useful clinically at very early stages to perhaps tell us if a child has a specific phenotype that would benefit more from this intervention versus that intervention, and help us actually make interventional decisions rather than be in a phenomenological studies. this, of course, calls for longitudinal studies at early ages and so forth. So I'd like to thank you and thank Nick again for organizing this session and take any questions you might have.
G'day. Ron. Thanks for a fascinating presentation. I guess one of the things that comes up for me, I'm a statistician, and one of the things that I see consistently when I'm teaching some of these techniques to people is that they're very powerful techniques, and you can find in a sufficiently large sample, you can find almost anything that you want, which is exactly part of the point that you're getting at. And I just wonder how you would place the role of theoretically driven research and theoretically driven questions as to clarifying what these methods find and how important that is.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by theoretically driven, but obviously a good hypothesis certainly is helpful in focusing the selection of the measurements you want to look at. Now, of course, and then interpretation is extremely important afterwards. We shouldn't be treating these as black boxes. We should place a lot of attention in, okay, you can achieve 90% classification. Let's look at what information is the classifier using and try to interpret it, try to guide further studies and so forth, link it to what we know about autism. This is very important. But I wouldn't want to restrict these methods too much on prior hypothesis, because their power is that these methods are hypothesis generation methods that, you know, for the first time we have the ability to actually look at a huge amount of data and find these patterns. So if we restrict them too much on what we know right now, they might not be able to find what we will know 10 years from now. But I think particularly interpretation of and linking of the findings with what we know about the anatomy and the function in autism is very important. Yeah.
Thank you very much for a really interesting talk. I thought your criticism on the Ecker et al. Paper was slightly unfair, because we all know that segmentation is never 100% accurate, which is why we work with probability maps. So the probability of a voxel to be in gray matter is negatively correlated with the probability of a voxel to be in white matter, which explains the different colored maps.
Yeah, I didn't criticize the study. It's a very nice study. I used it to emphasize the fact that we need to be careful with the conclusions we draw. Even fuzzy segmentations have exactly the same issue of interpretation. I initially interpreted the findings as volumetric differences, because that's what is reported, volumes of tissues, regardless if this comes from a categorical or fuzzy segmentation. But then, if you notice the results, you start to say, oh, maybe the interpretation is different. Maybe there are myelination differences that slightly tip the segmentation algorithm. While there appears to be less white matter in this region, it might actually mean that the white matter is there, it's just less myelinated. I just want to it's not a criticism, it's just an example of how the same finding could be interpreted in different ways.
Yes. Of course, the interpretation is always really difficult, which is why we try not to interpret the data, but just the overall accuracy. But as images, we are always interested in finding maps and finding, you know, particular regions, which is why we are often forced to interpret the data rather than saying there's high discriminative accuracy.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you want to order them, or can I just?
Could you speak first, please?
Thank you.
You talked about the classifier methods being like a black box, but I was just wondering, because that's certainly how I understand it. But I was wondering how much diversity underlies that black box, because there could be a few problems if there is a lot of diversity. Firstly, in the replicability of studies, and also, is there the potential, we talk about data mining sometimes, but is there the potential for methods mining, sort of coming up with any method that's going to sort of generate something from any data set? Can you comment on whether those are risks at all?
Well, certainly there's variability in terms of which classifiers and which models are used, and that creates an additional factor we should be concerned with. I don't think that the specific, it's hard to compare different methods because even the features they use are different. But there are some, the way they combine the features are different. So for example, if you take a decision, you know, decision tree, or if you take a support vector machine classifier. But the this variability starts to narrow down. There's a couple of machine learning methods that have been found to be generally very well replicable. For example, support vector machines have built-in mathematical ways of minimizing the generalization error, which is good. But yeah, it's something, an additional factor that brings, you know, variability to these findings.
Can you comment on the pattern recognition of like siblings and are you studying parents and siblings as a group to look for a pattern?
Not in this. I haven't done this, and not in autism. We're actually doing that together with Raquel and Rubengor in another disorder, in schizophrenia, and we're finding actually some very interesting results there of imaging phenotypes that are. We had a publication in that field. We haven't done it in autism yet, but I think it's something we need to do. But we found that imaging phenotypes found in schizophrenia are actually much more common in unaffected family members than in controls, basically. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Looks like one last question, please.
My son is approaching 50 years of age in September, so I started my search for problems in literature that's now largely forgotten. And I started with the articles of William Wendell on the effects on the brain of asphyxia at birth, and what they found were mainly subcortical sites in the auditory system and the subcortical motor system. And then about 10 years later, they published a paper on, they called it transneuronal degeneration, where obviously brain maturation did not take place normally, and it was different in every monkey. They all had these subcortical lesions, but the maturational process was not normal. And I wondered if maybe if you could make regions of interest in the auditory system and in the subcortical motor systems, if you might begin to see more uniform results.
If possibly, but again, this... these exploratory methods look at all brain regions at the same time. So they do look at also at subcortical and auditory regions. And some of the findings are in those regions, but not necessarily only in those regions. Could possibly, if you could exactly pinpoint the structure or the measurement that is the most distinctive, of course you would get a better result. But the problem is you don't know exactly which region you should outline. This is exactly where these data-driven methods come into play in this. Okay, because we cannot draw exactly a region of interest in a subcortical structure. You could, for example, take the thalamus, and that's fine, but it could be part of the thalamus. It could be part of the auditory cortex that is more affected. So because you don't know exactly how to draw this region of interest, you explore every part of the brain, and you try to piece together the pattern afterwards. Which has some pros and cons, but at least it gives us the opportunity to explore the data without having a biased a priori hypothesis, which if your hypothesis is right on target, you're probably better off starting with the hypothesis. But if your hypothesis is not right on target, then you might miss something that you would otherwise see.
Okay, I guess the cerebral cortex matures later in childhood, and if the subcortical guidance of those of the match of the cortical targets is affected, then you'll have a problem.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank Christos for an excellent talk.